Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Indiana legislature is in session, but things aren't running very smoothly. That's because of a hot-button issue called right to work. Republicans say it would improve Indiana's business climate. Democrats say it would weaken unions and drive down wages. But what is right to work? Here's the kind of definition that shows up in the news. Right to work is the measure banning contracts between companies and labor unions that impose mandatory representation fees for non-members. If your eyes just glazed over, stay with us. We'll put right to work into plain English and explain what's happening at the Indiana State House. To do that, we have Eric Bradner on the line from his office at the Capitol. He's State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press. And in the studio, we're joined by Keith Sermersheim. He's an employment and labor attorney at Rudolph, Fine, Porter & Johnson. Eric, I want to start with you. Business, I guess we could say, is good for State House reporters right now. Set the scene for us at the State House. What's been going on?
Sure. You've had hundreds of labor protesters, pro-labor protesters here every day, chanting while the House has been trying to cobble together the two-thirds quorum, that is two-thirds of all of the 100 members of the body that it takes to conduct any sort of business. Reporters, meanwhile, have been sort of running back and forth between the Speaker of the House, Brian Bosma, a Republican, and the Democratic leader, Pat Bauer. Bauer is saying Democrats are going to keep holding out, and Bosma is trying to force them back using fines and things of that nature, and Bauer is saying Democrats will continue to stay out. So it's quite hectic up here. These protests have filled the hallways with people, and I think a lot of people are confused about exactly where things are going from here.
And I guess, at least according to what you wrote this morning in the Courier and Press, it looks like Monday could be a big day for the House.
Yeah. Actually, this morning, Pat Bauer indicated that Democrats will be headed back to the House on Monday, most likely. He always leaves a little wiggle room. So Democrats have been trying to craft an amendment that would put this issue to the voters. Republicans, who have the majority in the House and the Senate, obviously want to pass a right-to-work law. Democrats, meanwhile, say, okay, well, if we're going to do this, there should be a referendum aspect involved. So Democrats have finally finalized their amendment. They introduced it this morning, and they say they will be back in the House to debate that amendment and others on Monday. So if that happens, that's the first step forward that right-to-work will have been able to take in the House, at least, in quite some time. Now, at the same time, in the Senate, they're considering amendments. They're doing that right now, a couple of floors above me. And so it looks like the Senate could vote next week as well on a right-to-work bill that might look a little bit different than the House's.
But a lot of this is happening because the Democrats are in the minority in both chambers, and they don't have a big enough minority, and they don't have enough people in the House to override what the Republicans want. So will Republicans go along with this proposed idea of a referendum, or are they simply going to say, no, we're not going to pass that, we need to do right to work right now?
Sure, yeah, they will vote it down. There is virtually no chance that any Democratic amendments will pass, especially the referendum one. What Democrats want to do is essentially get themselves on the record indicating that they want to give bring in this sort of direct democracy aspect. They want to give voters a say before right to work can become law. Republicans, on the other hand, are just not interested in that. Indiana is not a state that has traditionally had people decide issues like these with referenda. So Republicans are not interested, but Democrats want them to have to vote that way. Democrats want to be able to go into November 2012 and say, here's what we fought for. We tried to give voters a say, and Republicans voted no. They want to be able to use those votes against Republicans in campaigns.
Why is right to work a deal breaker for Democrats?
Well, several reasons. First and foremost, labor unions fund a lot of Democratic campaigns. They're unions such as the AFL-CIO, the Indiana State Teachers Association, which isn't really affected by this because it's sort of public workers, so that's a different story. But labor unions are a major funder of Democratic campaigns. The idea that workers don't have to pay money to the unions means the unions are on worse financial footing and therefore have less money to give to Democratic candidates. That's part of the idea here. Also, Democrats are saying that, you know, right to work would weaken these unions when they sit down at the negotiating table with businesses and therefore would undermine the rights of workers who have negotiated better pay, better benefits, better workplace protections as a result of the fact that everyone there, you know, everyone working there might not be required to join the union, but they do have to pay dues, and they are represented by the union in these negotiations.
And Eric Bradner from the Courier and Press starting to get at the definition of what right to work is all about. I want to bring Keith Sommersheim into the conversation here. And Keith, what's the basic definition of right to work?
Sure. To try to boil it down, right to work makes it unlawful for a labor union and an employer to require membership in the union or require payment of union dues or fees as a condition of employment to either get their job or to keep their job. Under current law, Indiana employers and unions regularly insert what's known as union security provisions in their collective bargaining agreements, and those require employees to pay union dues or remain in order to remain an employee of the company. If they don't pay the dues, they lose their job. If the right to work law is passed, employees can no longer be required to make payments to the union just to keep their job.
Okay, so if we go back in terms of U.S. Labor history, in 1947, there was a law that outlawed the closed union shop, which means that one has to join a union to work at a certain place. But I guess there's still some wriggle room in the form of these union securities where workers who aren't part of a union at a place of employment that's largely represented by a union still benefit from the collective bargaining and other things like that the union does. And so they have to pay something, even if it's not full union dues, they have to pay something into that union, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And so now what right to work says is you don't have to pay anything at all, but unions would argue, well, those people are still getting benefits like collective bargaining, but now they're not putting any money in the pot for that at all.
Well, yes, that's the union argument, is that they perceive there's going to be a mass shift of people away from the unions, that all of these people are going to somehow immediately stop paying the union dues and become free riders so that they get the benefits for the unions, even though they don't have to actually pay the dues. I think I look at right to work as a matter of individual choice. Employees will be able to choose to continue paying union dues if they believe the union is serving them well, or to not pay the dues if they believe the union is not being responsive to their needs or doing a good job for them. In fact, right to work may actually make unions better for their constituents. Unions in right to work states can't just take their members for granted because no one has to pay the union dues. If the unions want to retain the membership, they'll have to listen closely to their members and take action to ensure the members remain happy with their services. It's like any other service business or restaurant, really. If your customers are not happy with a service being provided, they can generally choose to spend their money elsewhere.
So it's voting with dollars, whereas now if you're part of a company that it has union representation, you've got to chip in something, even if you're not a member of that union. You're saying it'll allow people to simply decide this is a service I need and want or not.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, we're talking right to work with Keith Sommersheim. He's a labor attorney and employment attorney as well at Rudolph Fine Porter & Johnson. And also on the line from Indianapolis, we have Eric Bradner from the Courier and Press. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. This is The Trend. You're listening to The Trend here on 88.3 WNIN and online at WNIN.org. Support for the program today comes from our contributing listeners and through a grant from the Charles and Jan Stiftenagel family, who encourage your support of public broadcasting. This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Coming up, Tech Talk and Books for Inmates. Right now we're talking with Courier and Press Statehouse reporter Eric Bradner and labor and employment attorney Keith Sommersheim. And Eric, I want to turn back to you. You know, if right to work is as simple as simply saying, I'm voting for a service with my dollars or not, why has this become such an emotional issue and such a divisive issue at the Statehouse?
Well, I think that this is something that's been divisive in Indiana for literally decades. I mean, in 1957, Indiana, for the first time, passed a right-to-work law, and it was repealed, of course, in 1965 after Democrats captured control of the State House from Republicans. But this is really, in a lot of ways, a political turf war. The Indiana Chamber and other business lobbyists are strongly in favor of right to work, and they're putting a lot of money behind it. They spend money getting Republican candidates elected, and they have spent a lot of money on advertising in this right to work battle, and they'll spend a lot more money in 2012 trying to get rid of those who vote no. Democrats, meanwhile, are, you know, as I mentioned earlier, trying to protect the people who are sort of the base of their party. So that's a big part of it. The notion that, yeah, you know, these labor unions are convinced, right or wrong, that the right to work would truly undermine them and their ability to negotiate for their members. They really believe that. And so Democrats are willing to go farther to try to block a right-to-work bill than they would for pretty much anything else.
And Keith Sommersheim, you know, Eric's talking about business, about unions. These are large entities. What about the individual? I mean, what change do you see for the person who works at a shop where union representation is an option?
Yeah, sure. That's a good question. How will it impact the average working person? I mean, if you're currently employed in a non-union workplace, it's going to have no effect at all. And the majority of Indiana workers are non-union. But if you're currently employed in an organized workplace under a collective bargaining agreement, you must continue paying your union dues until their current collective bargaining agreement expires. In that regard, one of the things I've been watching in the right to work bill and the one that's currently involved in the House is the question of when will that law become effective and how's it going to work? The current bill states that it becomes effective March 14th, 2012. Now, that doesn't mean that employees will be permitted to stop paying dues on March 14th. Rather, the bill states the provisions only apply to collective bargaining agreements entered into, modified, renewed, or extended after March 14, 2012. They don't apply to abrogate or negate, the collective bargaining agreements. It's only for new agreements and revised agreements. Those agreements usually get renegotiated every 3 years.
Okay, so it's not March 14th. Anyone can just say, well, I'm yanking my dues here.
Exactly. It won't be a mass exodus of all unionized workers going to turn around and yank their dues on March 14th. Rather, it's going to roll into effect as those union contracts expire and get renegotiated. So if you're in an organized workplace right now, you have to wait until the contract expires before you can make the decision whether you want to keep paying your union dues, whether the union's doing a good job for you or not.
Well, I know one of the things people look at the other 22 states that have right to work and try to read those tea leaves, as it were, to figure out what will happen in Indiana. And some of what I've heard is that you can read whatever you want into those tea leaves because the data is so complex and each state is so different. But generally speaking, have we seen a movement away from unions or a decline in wages in those states where right to work is in effect?
Well, you know, each side relies on studies and statistics to support their position. And I've reviewed several of those studies to try to understand the arguments for each side. You know, the unions do argue that the right to work laws lead to lower wages, hurt unions, lower standards of living, reduce workplace safety, and encourage freeloading. And the proponents of right to work contend the law will actually lead to higher wages, reduce unemployment, create jobs by attracting businesses, improve accountability, and they're morally right because people will no longer be forced to pay dues to a labor union, which they may not support. Each side relies on these studies, and they firmly believe what those studies say. However, you know, the statistics don't lie, but the way you group and organize that information is highly subject to manipulation. So, you know, I think if you look at any of those studies from the most recent states being Idaho and Oklahoma, you can look at that information and take it any way you want. But my impression of it is on the economic issues, it doesn't really have a huge impact one way or the other. And really, it comes back down to what I said before. It seems to be a matter of individual choice. Are we going to let people decide whether they want to support the unions or not? And again, if the unions have done a good job, I don't think that the people are going to flee the unions. If you look at the teachers' union, for example, that particular union has been right to work for a long time, and they don't have a mass exodus of people, and they don't have a massive number of free riders taking the benefits without paying the dues. So I believe that it's probably much ado about nothing to a large degree, and Eric's right. It's a matter of political power, what we're really fighting over here.
And Eric, I imagine you'd have people, protesters in the Capitol Rotunda who would bristle at the idea of much ado about nothing. What's your response to that?
Sure, they would. You know, there are a couple of arguments that they make. First of all, Indiana is not a union state in the sense of, you know, some of its neighbors in the Great Lakes region. But in Indiana, people who are members of unions are arguing that the fact that they exist and are fairly strong right now, and that there's no right to work law, enables them to negotiate and get rights that have an impact outside of union shops. They point to other manufacturers, especially some auto businesses. The Toyota plant in Gibson County might be an example where no union exists right now, but employers are treating their employees fairly well because they fear that if they don't, those employees might organize. So the labor union supporters are arguing that this would have a reach outside of just them and within their union and within their workplace. They think this would affect everybody in Indiana.
Now, a lot of what we've been talking about is the ideology that there are two sides to this who believe very passionately and very deeply that they are right on this issue. But we're also seeing two cases, at least in the legislature, where constituents are sort of overruling ideology. And that's in the case of Representative Ron Bacon from southwestern Indiana and Senator Jim Toms from southwestern Indiana, who I guess on principle and because they're both Republicans, would generally agree with right to work, but they've heard from so many constituents against it now that they say they'll oppose it. Are they outliers in the state house, Eric?
They are. Actually, a lot of the Republican opposition to right to work does come from southwestern Indiana. You mentioned two people. Another is Representative Mark Messmer from Jasper, who actually is not going to vote. He's not going to vote yes or no. He's not going to vote because he runs a business that is a union shop. So, however, no, Republicans have the votes they need. Democrats do not, and Republicans can afford to lose a few people.
And that sounds like a good place to leave it. And in fact, we have to leave it there because our time is up. Evansville Courier and Press State House reporter Eric Bradner was talking with us, as well as Keith Sermersheim, an employment and labor attorney at Rudolph Fine Porter & Johnson. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
It's time now for Tech Talk, where our associate producer Tony Voss and technology expert Justin Williams bring us news and tips from the tech world. And this week, Tony, we conclude our series on 2012 predictions.
Yeah, that's right, Micah. So far, we've looked at desktop computers, laptops, and tablets, and we've managed to not even mention that whole Mayan calendar doomsday thing. So to bring our series to a close, we're going to look at mobile phones. And Justin started off this week by dispelling a common tech world misconception.
We should preface this by saying that even right at this point, the majority of people in the world are not using smartphones. They're still using quote-unquote dumb phones. So there's still room for growth in the smartphone market because there's so many people that have yet to get them, either because the phones are too expensive or they don't want to pay for the data plans or whatnot. But right now, I think that we are in this kind of 2.5-horse race. And you've got, on one end, we've got Apple with iOS, and on the other end, we've got Google with Android. But kind of the dark horse and the half horse in this race is Microsoft with Windows Phone. And I think people that have listened to this for a while know that I am a fan of Windows Phone. And what makes me think that they might have more of a chance this year is Nokia is planning to come back to the US market this year in a big way with Windows Phone as their OS of choice. So why does this make a difference for Microsoft? Right now, the problem that Microsoft has with Windows Phone is that when you go into an AT&T store or Verizon or a T-Mobile store or whatever it is, and you go and you look at all the phones, you see the Android phones, you see the Windows phones, you see the iPhones. And other than the iPhone, which is this slab of glass, the Windows phones look exactly like the Android phones, other than having a different operating system on top of them and kind of being nestled into a corner because the salesmen aren't pitching it. But the problem is that the hardware is the exact same as what is being used by these Android devices because the LGs, HTCs, and Samsungs are basically just rebranding Android hardware and putting Windows Phone onto it. What you're going to get with Nokia, on the other hand, is a company that knows how to build really great best-of-breed hardware, taking their best-of-breed hardware and putting Windows Phone, which is a really unique and interesting experience that I'm a really big fan of. So you take that great hardware, you take that great software, and I think it has a little bit more of an eye-catching appeal whenever you go into your cell phone store to kind of pick your next phone. Will that make a difference in terms of people actually buying them or salesmen actually pushing them? I think it could, but again, it's kind of remains to be seen.
Aside from Windows Phone, the two big horses in this race, of course, are Apple and Google. And what are we likely to see out of them this year?
I think we're going to just see both of those companies continue to push their platforms ahead. So you're going to see the next version of the iPhone. It's probably going to be called the iPhone 5. You'll probably see the next version of iOS, iOS 6. You'll probably see more and more phones get Ice Cream Sandwich, aka Android 4.0, which was just shipped towards the end of last year. So you're going to see more phones updated to that, new phones ship with that. And probably towards the end of the year or middle of the year, you'll see the next version of Android come out of Google. But how long it will take them to get that onto phones remains to be seen, because as always, Google has this problem where all of their devices aren't running the same version of the OS as easily as devices from Microsoft with Windows Phone or Apple with iOS are.
Will there be any advances towards unifying that process? I know there was several carriers that made kind of a promise that they would be better about these things during 2011. Do you think there will be any traction towards making it so that Android phone users will actually get the current Android version?
No, and it's funny that you mentioned that. That was at Google I.O. last year when Google came out on stage and said that they had set up a partnership with all the handset manufacturers and carriers to guarantee updates for Android phones for the next 18 months. But what they didn't say and what kind of came out after that announcement was that Google hadn't actually figured out how that was going to work. And when asked about it, they said, well, we'll figure it out in the next couple of weeks. And they never did figure that out. We're still having that same problem of devices are not being updated to the latest version of Android after they're shipped. And that's interesting to me because I think that could bring about some sort of consumer backlash to Android, because it's not a good feeling when you spend a lot of money on a new smartphone and then 6 months later you find out that it's completely out of date and you're not going to get updates to it when you see your friends that are using Windows Phone or Apple's iPhone continuing to get updates for 2 years or even beyond that. So it's definitely a problem for Google. It's something that they need to figure out, but I'm not sure how they can solve it, because by making Android a quote-unquote open source platform that they just put out there for anyone to use, what these handset manufacturers have done to differentiate themselves is they've put all of these custom layers and skins on top of it. So you are running Android, but the Samsung Android experience is not the same as the HTC Android experience or even Google's specific Nexus experience. So we've got Android is kind of the base, but all these different kind of Android sub-platforms out there that make this sort of a hairy and possibly unsolvable situation.
And the situation will remain the same for The Trend as well, as the Motley crew here at this program makes it available online right after the show, as usual. At WNIN.org, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, check out past episodes, and send us some feedback at our Facebook page or by regular old-school email. Something like that. Thanks, Micah.
Thank you, Tony. This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We're joined now by the library lady. At least that's what she's called at the Vandenberg and Posey County jails. While getting her master's in library science, Gail Lee saw a need for books at the jails, and she's here to tell that story along with her assistant, Eva Sanford, who's in charge of outreach at Evansville's Willard Library. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Eva, do you have a nickname?
Oh, well, for the library?
Yeah.
Service? No,
library ladies.
Yeah, you're the library ladies. Well, Gail, why did you start a jail library?
Well, it started with a librarian from the Monroe County Public Library. They had a jail library there, and I was fascinated by it.
Because you were going to school at IU.
Right, and working on my master's. And so I decided to do an internship there at the jail library at Monroe County Jail. But I also decided to work on a directed research project with a professor, which allowed me to then study the jail library, different jail libraries, and take that and apply it to Vandenberg County Jail to start library service there.
And I guess you're studying jail libraries, but in the process you're discovering that a lot of jails don't have libraries.
That's correct. It took me a while to research and find a jail library to study. One was in Richmond, Indiana. That's Wayne County. And their services are different. So the Monroe County Jail Library actually has a library inside the jail. And Richmond, actually, their library is on book carts. And so I looked at what Vandenberg County, their the building itself and what would work best. They didn't have a library space for me. So I decided to then create, collect books and then put books on book carts. One of my book carts is fiction and one of them's nonfiction. And so my library's on wheels.
So why don't jails have libraries? I mean, it seems sort of like a no-brainer, right? Wouldn't that be something they would offer?
Well, funding, you know, money. It takes money to do that and time. Really, a lot of my I don't have any money right now, any funding coming in. Most of my donations are most of my books are donations from the public. Evansville Junior League donated books from their garage sale. I was able to collect all those books. That was my starting point. Oak Hill School held a book drive. My daughter went to school there. And so I got a lot of my YA books and easy readers, high interest mm-hmm. but low literacy books. And then Willard Library. Willard Library came in and at a later time and helped me fill those requests by the inmates.
Because you've been going for about a year and a half now.
Uh-huh.
And I guess, what, about 8 months ago or so, Eva Sanford, you got involved.
Right. And how that happened is basically I'd been working 8 years for Even Start, which is a program through Lampion Center, which helps teen mothers who have dropped out of school because of their pregnancies, and then later they come to this program to learn how to read and do math and everything while they have childcare. And I would go there and do a literary book circle with them for years and hone up their reading skills mm-hmm. so that they could get a better job. This program got cut and cut and cut because it was a government program. It still exists, but my need to be there was becoming less and less. So Willard Library, basically, Greg Hager, the director of the library, cares very much for doing outreach work in the community. And that's, we're in the Carpenter House right now. Willard Carpenter was all about giving education to everybody. And I mean everybody, no matter what your background was. So I was looking for another program. And in enters Gail.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now now you've got an actual physical library behind this. Do you use books from the Willard, or how does that work?
Yes, basically, thanks to the Friends of the Willard Library, especially Mary Lou Sontag, people give donations all year round, every kind of book you could possibly imagine. I go down to the donation area, go through the books, and Gail and I keep track of what people want. If somebody says, hey, I'm trying to get my math skills back so that I can pass a test when I get out of here. We had a truck driver, remember that? He needed a CDL test.
Yes, and we got that.
We have people who say, my marriage is falling apart. I would love a self-help book on relationships. People who've never really used books before to get this kind of information. It's like a therapist on pages.
Therapy. Yeah.
And so I go hunt those books down and pull them out of all the donations.
And this seems like a great place to bring another voice into the conversation. This is an inmate at the Vandenberg County Jail, and his name is Kenny, and here's what he has to say.
It's a good opportunity, even though it's a negative situation for us and for our families. It's a good opportunity for a person to develop a good reading habit and to gain some insight from books.
So, Gail Lee, what kind of insight do inmates gain?
Well, you know, it's so funny because you never know. I go in there thinking I have all these books and donations, and I put all sorts of things on there. And it always amazes me what they check out, anything from classics to, like she said, self-help. But it's not just what they read. It's they're sharing. They're having book discussions in there. One person in particular loved the book The Shack, and this was a female. And she was in there telling her other female about this book. She's like, oh, you got to read this book. It's wonderful. And the girl admitted to her, the woman did, said, I can't read. So the young woman who started reading The Shack started from the very beginning and read it out loud to her. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, those are stories I would never can imagine was happening there. I had another man who checked out a cookbook, and I said, oh, you're a chef. And he said, no. He's like, but I'm going to be out in 2 weeks, and I want to plan a menu for my wife and make her dinner. You know, things that I would never imagine. And it's my way of making a difference, though, through books.
I imagine it certainly helps pass the time, but it's so much more than that, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And like she said, we take requests for them. So if they are taking like a driver's ed test or, you know, they are having relationship problems, parenting, there are women in there that are pregnant that ask for pregnancy books. They really care and they want to make a difference. I mean, the thing is that, you know, 95% of these individuals will be coming back into the community. And so my goal is to help them make a successful reentry back into the community. And I'm hoping that they can find a book that will make that process a little easier.
You're working with donated books here, and you're doing this by request too, which is pretty impressive in terms of the time. But if somebody requests a certain book, how do you know you're going to have it?
Well, they know, and we tell them all the time, these are donations, so we try our best. The big issue usually is a series. Somebody gets hooked on a series like Harry Potter or, you know, sci-fi Aragon, and, you know, they want to go through the whole thing, you know, and they see us, and they're so excited. We haven't been there for 2 weeks, maybe, and they'll be like, oh, I'm ready for book number three, you know, and it's so exciting to know that not only are they reading one book, hell, they're reading eight in the whole series. So it's about, I think, putting a positive light in a negative place. I mean, they're there, sitting there, and I think it's about rehabilitation and about giving somebody something positive, treating them like a human being, treating them with respect. And you just put it out there.
Which I don't find that. I mean, with books, I offer choice in an environment that is they're told when to sleep, what to eat, when to have rec. The library offers choice. They go out, they can spend some time browsing with books. Not much, Grant. I mean, very little time, but yet it does allow them choice. And that makes them feel kind of normal in a negative, you know, dark place. And so that, I think that's what we do.
I imagine one could get depressed easily in jail.
Yes. And these books, and they've said it so many times that, you know, you've kept me sane. You know, these books have kept me sane, and you coming, because, you know, it is very difficult. And you can see some of them when they walk up. They've never been there, or, you know, this is their first time, and they have that look of fear, you know. But I think books make a difference, yeah.
Jail libraries are trending now. We'll have more after a break. We're talking with Gail Lee and Eva Sanford, who run the jail library program in Vandenberg County and Posey County. More in a minute. This is The Trend.
You are listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and at WNIN.org. Support for the program comes from Evansville Day School, preparing for college, preparing for life for over 60 years. Information online at evansvilledayschool.org.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We're talking about jail libraries with Gail Lee and Eva Sanford, and we've got photos of the Vandenberg County Jail Library, or at least of the carts that comprise that library, on our Facebook page. You can go check those out right now at facebook.com/WNIN Trend. And Gail Lee, we've talked a bit about the response that you've gotten from the inmates, but what about from the people who work at the jail? What kind of response has this library gotten from them?
Well, they've been very supportive, I have to say, especially the correctional officers, because they're the ones that have to bring the inmates out and keep them moving. And sometimes it takes a while. I actually check out the books to each inmate. So we write down the titles of what they have and keep track of that. So they have to. So when I come back in 2 weeks, they have to actually return those books to me to get more. That right now they're allowed 3 books because I do see them every 2 weeks. But Major Titzer and Sheriff Williams have been very supportive and flexible. There's times where I can't. I go on Fridays, every Friday. And I also go every other Saturday. And there's been some times where I've had to change my schedule, and they've been very, very flexible. So I really appreciate that.
Do you get all the books back?
No, I don't. That has been a problem. The thing is, when people leave, they leave their books in the cell, and then they circulate, you know, throughout the pods. And the thing is, I mean, my whole goal is to get them reading. And so I, you know, they always come back and say, oh, they took my books, or, you know, I passed them out. And I'm like, you know, you got to get those books back. But I do allow them to check out books, just not maybe the high interest ones.
Harry Potter's.
Your Harry Potter's, Twilight, your James Patterson, your Twilight's. Yes. Yeah. They can go and find another book. So.
Let's bring Kenny back into the discussion. Again, he's an inmate at the Vandenberg County Jail, and here's something else he wanted to share.
It's a real good thing for us to have back there in the cell unit, so that a lot of times television, you know, is good, but when you have a book, it's a personal thing, and you can read it when the other inmates are, like, asleep. Or at recreation, you can open up a good book there. And most of the guys back there really guard this privilege, take care of it, and are really thankful for it.
So, Eva Sanford, this is a privilege.
That he just brought up a great point, and that is, you know, people always say, oh, you go to the jail. But you know what? They are so polite.
Very polite.
The majority, couple incidences where there was
problem out of tons of times going there. You know, people are grateful. They are respectful of us as ladies.
Than
the regular public. They often say, I want to do good by you because I don't want this. I don't want to lose my privileges. This is something I look forward to. I look forward to this.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. They'll, you know, it's exciting to look at them grab a book and they're like, yes, and they run off to their cell to begin reading it.
And then we also give out picture books, which the jail has been very kind to let us do that as well for people who maybe are illiterate, or if we run out of Spanish-speaking books or books of other languages, or if somebody doesn't have their glasses, they can just look at beautiful pictures of national parks. They can, you know, look at how great the world is and think about, oh, you know what? I might want to travel there someday. You know, maybe I want to change my life, and maybe this is something I could have as a goal. It opens people's hearts up, I think.
Mm-hmm. When you became librarians, did you have any sense of this kind of these lofty ideals with being a librarian?
Well, I think, you know, when you're dealing with the world of books, you're dealing with imagination, you're dealing with traveling to another place. And that's what this is, really. It's a place of four walls and, you know, bars and dismal, dry air. This is a chance to not just escape, but to dream of something better, to improve yourself. Why wouldn't you want to take a chance if somebody wants to take it on you? Why not go for it?
What about you, Gail? Did you imagine that being a librarian could tap into such big ideas?
You know, no. I wanted to be an outreach librarian. I just didn't know that's what this meant, you know, going to jail every week. But it has been very rewarding just to be able to be a part of this. And you know, it's not at all what I thought it was going to be. I mean, they're very thankful, like she said, and they appreciate us coming. And I know that's one thing they look forward to. But no, I never thought that.
So what did people say when you said, oh, I've started a new project, I go to the library and hand out books?
They say, you mean they can read? They're really surprised, and it's sad. And I get that, you know, the news and all. But, you know, the thing is these people are good people. They've just made bad choices, many of these. I mean, yeah, there's some bad people in there. But to me, the jail is a place of second chances. Mm-hmm. It's not just a place to keep them away from society because they've done bad things. It's an opportunity, if they want it, to give them a second chance.
What about reactions that you've had from people, Eva?
Yeah, they usually say, are you scared? Well, it's an amazingly run facility. I'm never frightened because we have, you know, wonderful protection at all times. And like we mentioned before, they don't want to mess it up.
Exactly.
You know, they don't want to lose their privilege. It's like losing rec time, you know. I do want to say, you know, that this is a chance too for, we could just go there and drop the books off and not be there. But part of being there is having that personal interaction, person to person, and that's a rare thing.
Yeah, and they are treated like human beings. They're not just treated, you know. We try to make them feel normal, and we have conversations and book discussions. That's mm-hmm. what I think. They'll tell me about books that they've read, and you ought to read this. And so, yeah.
So do you keep these carts at the library, or do you drive around with a big truck with books loaded up?
Although my car, yeah, I do have a lot of books all the time in my mm-hmm. car. But no, they are housed there. So that's where we kind of do need help for volunteers. If people would be interested in helping us repair books or organize some of these books. It's away from where the inmates are. So, I mean, but they are housed at the jail.
Like in a storage area.
In the sheriff's wing.
Okay, yeah. We've got photographs of that on our Facebook page. I guess you can't hand out hardcover books, though, right?
No, and that's where Willard comes in. Mm-hmm. They've done a great job cutting off those hardcovers, and then they'll put tape. And really, it stays together pretty well. The only unfortunate thing is there's not usually
pretty
it's not as pretty, and, you know, it's not as eye-catching. But they still get checked out and used. And that's the thing with inmates. They don't care what it looks like. And it's so funny. When you get a lot of these books back, they'll have deodorant tape on there. They really try to take care of these books. But, mm-hmm. you know, they fall apart. They're paperback. They're not made to last. And they're past you know, through hands. I mean, there's probably, I know my statistics do not reflect how many times that book has been read, because you
there's
can tell.
There's 8 people in a cell. So you imagine 3 books per person. Those are all getting circulated in that cell. Now they come out of the cells and have time together. Mm-hmm. Those books are getting circulated.
Right.
So you imagine they're reading 3 books. No, they're not reading 3 books. By the time we come back, they could have read 15.
Yes, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you need more books?
We always need more books because there's certain subjects that everybody wants. Thesauruses, dictionaries.
That's the number one book.
For writing letters. I believe they use them
lawyers
to write letters.
And at home and things like that. Westerns and fantasy seem to be lacking.
Science fiction.
Science fiction. And current medical or current self-help books.
Yes, always self-help.
But clean books, mm-hmm. you know.
Drop them off at the Willard Library?
Yes, I'm going to put a box out so that we can do that, make that easier for people. But they can always just find me, too.
Gail Lee and Eva Sanford run the Vandenberg and Posey County Jail Libraries. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN. Support comes from the Evansville Philharmonic Orchestra, presenting its Spirit of Romance concert featuring works by Beethoven and Brahms and showcasing cellist Kevin Bate on Herbert's Cello Concerto No. 2, Saturday, January 21st at 7 p.m. at the Victory Theater. To get information available at evansvillephilharmonic.org or 812-425-5050.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and it's that time. Time for the Arts Notebook with Roger McBain from the Courier and Press. Hi, Roger.
Good morning. Good afternoon, I should say. I always forget. This
That's
is
right.
afternoon.
Well, and by the time this re-airs on Sunday, it's evening, and then who knows what time it is when people listen online. So hello to you as well. Let's start with some nice alliteration. Art by Architects, which is on display at the Arts Council of Southwestern Indiana on Main Street in Evansville.
That's right, 318 Main Street. This is the second year for this show. And this year there are about a dozen area architects and members of their staff who have got about 40 pieces of art in there. The art that basically is the foundation and the inspiration for what they do with buildings.
Well, and as you wrote in your article, architecture is very creative work, but it's functional in a way that fine art doesn't have to be.
It really is a science. It involves physics. It involves mechanics. It involves engineering. The foundation for a lot of this, these people have turned to, and they're in the show, they have abstract paintings, graphics, sculpture, photography. Mike Shoulders, who is a prominent Evansville architect, has worked with photography for years. He started with 35mm and he's graduated to digital, and now he's manipulating images, and he has some stuff in the show, surreal images of a man's Oxfords descending from the clouds, and another image that involves the Korean War Memorial in Washington, D.C., with an overlay of the White House and missiles and that sort of thing.
And you can actually see some of those at courierpress.com. Those are linked to your article. We've got a link to that as well on our Facebook page, and so you can check that out. So this show, Art by Architects, opens tonight.
The reception is tonight.
Yeah.
And it's from 4 to 7 p.m. today. There's going to be music. There's going to be wine, hors d'oeuvres, and all the art and the artists there, 318 Main Street.
Okay. And while we're talking about the Arts Council, we should also briefly mention their Brown Bag Performance Series.
That's right. Just about every Wednesday at noon, they have some kind of a performance there. You can bring your lunch in, sit down. It doesn't cost anything. This coming week, it's the Harlaxton Wind Quartet. Quintet,
yeah, 5 of them. So that'll be on Wednesday the 25th. And on to more music, the Evansville Philharmonic Orchestra performs this weekend, and one of the orchestra's lower voices gets to be in the spotlight.
The principal cellist, Kevin Bate, will be featured in the Victor Herbert Cello Concerto No. 2. This was a composition by Victor Herbert. He was a late 19th century virtuoso cellist, also a conductor, and mainly remembered now as a composer of operetta. But this piece in particular, he played the premiere for in New York in the late 1800s. And Antonin Dvorak was in the audience, and it inspired him to write his own more famous cello concerto.
And Kevin Bate is normally the principal cellist at the EPO, like you mentioned, but that's in the orchestra, and this must be a bit different to sit in front of it next to the conductor.
Normally he's upstaged by the conductor, as is everyone in the orchestra. He's coming out of the section. He's going to be on a platform next to the conductor. He says it's a big adrenaline rush to get out there.
And, of course, it's not his only time in front of an orchestra in his career, or it's not even the only orchestra he plays with. He gets around.
He also plays a principal cello with the Owensboro Symphony Orchestra, the Orchestra Kentucky, and Bowling Green, and he's a substitute for orchestras in Indianapolis and Detroit. And he's in the Eykamp String Quartet along with his wife and brother. And his wife is the associate concertmaster for the Philharmonic as well. And his brother, Craig, is the principal viola.
Okay, so a family affair there. And I guess his musical studies, he's studied in Indiana, but also in other places as well. So he's gone around there as well.
He's a Wisconsin native. He studied at the University of Wisconsin. He also went to Germany and studied at the Musikhochschule in Freiburg. And then he was at IU with Janos Starker.
Oh, a very famous cellist, yeah. And so now, in addition to this concerto that the EPO is performing, they're also featuring some other 19th century music at their concert.
Johannes Brahms' Symphony No. 1 and Ludwig van Beethoven's Leonore Overture.
Okay, and when does this all take the stage?
7 p.m. Saturday in the Victory.
Okay, and I should mention the concert will also be broadcast right here on WNIN, but you have to wait. It's not until February 5th. You can find Roger McBain's articles in Thursday's Courier and Press and also at courierpress.com. And Roger joins us every week for a look at regional arts happenings. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
Next week, what the closing of the town's school means for New Harmony. And as Evansville becomes a hockey town, we'll figure out the rules to the game. You can send us questions and comments for the show. Just click on the trend at WNIN.org and you'll find links for Facebook, Twitter, and email. Podcasts are there as well at WNIN.org. You can also find them at CourierPress.com. Plus, we're on iTunes and in the NPR podcast directory. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. The show is produced by Brad Conaway and Tony Voss. Tony also engineers the show. And our producer at the Courier and Press is Ryan Reynolds. Jeffrey Osman composed the theme music. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk again next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.